Yes, it is. So we're learning Tractate Baba Kama, Masechet Baba Kama. We're the end of the seventh chapter, Perek Shvi'i. And this Mishnah is not similar to any other Mishnah we've seen before in the whole Masechet. It's going to be interesting. Let's make sure we have the material. So we're in Perek Shvi'i, the seventh chapter.
Which page do you have? 57?
And we need the text, of course, and we need the sources that I sent out. Looks like everyone's doing pretty good. So let's read the Mishnah. Ready?
Yes.
Ready. Ein migadlin beima daka be'eretz Yisrael. Which is pretty straightforward, right? We don't raise something called the beima daka in Eretz Yisrael. Avo migadlin besuya. But we do raise in Syria and in the deserts of Eretz Yisrael. We'll come back to everything here. Every single word we'll come back to. Ein migadlin tarnagolim b'Yishalayim mipnei hakodeshim. We don't raise tarnagolim, right, chickens, in Yerushalayim mipnei hakodeshim. And by the way, notice the way I pronounce that word kodeshim. Under the kuf is a kamatz, but it's not a normal kamatz, right? It's a chatat kamatz. Means it has a shva on the right-hand side of the kamatz, so it's a chatat kamatz. And the proper pronunciation, at least according to the Sephardi way of pronouncing things, is that a chatat kamatz is pronounced like an O sound. So it's kodeshim.
May I add something?
Of course.
If there is a kamatz after chataf kamatz, it's pronounced like kamatz katan.
Ah, so then, right.
Kodoshim. Mm-hmm.
No. Can you say it again?
Yeah.
Kodo, here.
Yeah.
Are you sure?
Can I get that to you?
Because that's not the way we pronounce it usually.
I know. It's a Hebrew grammar was forgotten.
Okay, so Ilana says. Okay, what can I say?
I'm sorry.
I will find you at the Asmachta to the week and bring it.
Okay.
What's wrong?
Oh, just switching chairs here.
Sit on that chair.
I see. So anyway, we don't raise chickens in Yerushalayim because of the Kodeshim. We'll come back to that as well. V'lo Kohanim b'Eretz Yisrael, and not Kohanim in Eretz Yisrael. That's really not clear. Does that mean we don't raise Kohanim in Eretz Yisrael? Probably not.
Means that important.
That Kohanim shouldn't raise chickens in all of Eretz Yisrael, right? Not just Yerushalayim, but in all of Eretz Yisrael. And actually, we'll see later that Rashi has a different girsa, different text that makes it a little bit clearer. And the reason for that is mipnei ha-toharot. And here also my pronunciation, I said tohorot.
You see? Yeah.
Right?
Because there it's reversed.
Ah, maybe it's the other way.
Again.
You're right.
Because the kamatz the kamatz there is a kamatz katan. Without explaining what that means, there's two different types of kamatzim. It's a kamatz katan, which has the pronunciation of O. Mipnei ha-tohorot.
You're right. My comment was wrong. It's the kamatz that comes before the chataf kamatz, that is kamatz katan.
I see.
Okay.
Yeah. So we should
say
kodashim.
I have no comment. Ein migadlin hazirim b'chol makom. We don't raise hazirim, pigs, in any place. And apparently that means not just Jerusalem. It's forbidden not just Eretz Yisrael, but b'chol makom, in any place. Even in Dallas, you can't raise pigs if you're Jewish. Lo yigadel adam et hakelev elim kein haya kashur b'shal shelet. Right? One shouldn't raise a dog except if it is kashur, if it is tied with a shal shelet, with a leash. Noni.
Raise as in, or raise as in, like,
grow.
Oh.
It says rear, not raise.
Well, yeah, I'm giving you my translation. The word in Hebrew is ligadel, right, to grow, to keep.
So if the dog is in the house, he has to be tied with a chain?
That's a good question. We will actually discuss that question later.
I have to tie my dog up in the house.
Ein porsin nishbim leyonim. Elim kein, ayarachok mina yeshuv shloshim ris. We don't spread out nets or traps, nishbim are traps, for yonim, for pigeons. Elim kein, ayarachok mina yeshuv shloshim ris. Except if you were distant from a place that people live, a yeshuv, a settlement, shloshim ris. And shloshim ris is about 4 kilometers. Okay, so that's very, very basically. Let's go through the Mishnah, explaining some concepts, asking some questions. We have the question sheets to help us out. Let's try to begin. So, the first line of the Mishnah, going back, is Ein migadlin beima daka beretz Yisrael. We don't raise beima daka in Eretz Yisrael. And the question is, what is a beima daka? So, literally, beima daka, a thin animal. Thin animal.
Like deer?
Behemoth.
Well, that would be a chaya. That would be an animal. Right? In Hebrew, behema is a domesticated animal.
Oh, I understand.
A chaya is a wild animal. So what animal might be referred to by the term behema daka? Thin animal.
Goats.
Or?
Sheep.
Sheep. Goats and sheep are behema daka. As opposed to?
Cows.
Cows, which are behema?
Gasa.
Gasa. Say it again.
Horses?
Horses are not discussed at all.
Horses were connected with the Greeks.
I don't know if horses were raised at all in Eretz Yisrael in time of the Mishnah. I don't know of any discussion.
Did they have cavalry?
Did they have cavalry? The Jews certainly didn't.
And I guess the king can't have many horses.
Right. The Egyptians are known as for having cavalry in the sense of livriut, horses for the chariots. And like your father said, the Torah discusses the fact that the king, lo yerbelo susim, shouldn't have a lot of susim. So anyway, going back to this...
Royal bay implies that he can have a few, no?
But we're not talking about the king there. We're back to the Mishnah.
Yeah.
So it's beima daka and beima gasa. The beima gasa, apparently, the cattle are not forbidden. Whereas the beima daka is forbidden to raise an Eretz Yisrael. So the minute we read this, we immediately... Say it again?
Is it based on any mikra?
No. As in Yeshua would say, pumfarkert, on the opposite, right? On the contrary, because there's every reason, reading the Torah and the whole Tanakh, to think that the last thing in the world that we should learn about, that we should hear about, is that it should be forbidden to raise a beimot daka. Because everyone raised beimot dakot, right? From the very beginning of Hevel, Abel, right? He was a roet zon. He was a shepherd of zon.
In necessarily in Eretz Yisrael.
Well, it depends who you ask. According to okay, that's a good
and
point.
Abraham.
But you go to Abraham, Yitzchak, Yaakov,
okay.
right? They're all
King David,
right?
Yeah.
And not only are our patriarchs roet zon, but to such a degree is being a roet zon, a shepherd of sheep, a fundamental theme within the Tanakh that God becomes the roeh, yeah. The shepherd, roeh Yisrael. Right, he's the shepherd of
Adonai roeh.
Right, Hashem roeh lo etzar. God is my shepherd; I shall not want. Why is God called the shepherd? Because that metaphor is so clearly known to the people of Eretz Yisrael, to the Jewish people. So the Tanakh is full of tzon, of sheep, and the idea of roeh tzon as a profession, as a metaphor, as an idea. For Moshe also was a roeh tzon, just not in Eretz Yisrael. And then suddenly the Mishnah says you're not allowed to be a roeh tzon. Right, that's what it means. Ein migadlin beima daka.
Wasn't that Amos?
In Tekoa.
Yes.
Actually, that's interesting because Tekoa is in Midbarot Shevet Yisrael, as we're about to talk about.
Uh-huh.
Right. So it says you're not allowed to be Migadel Beima Daka in Yisrael. We're asking ourselves, we have a lot of questions, as how could that be, given the Tanakh? But then we do learn that you're allowed to have sown in Surya and in the Midbarot Shel Eretz Yisrael. Now, Surya is the area that today is basically Drom Surya, Drom Marav.
Drom Marav, yes.
Surya, which means, you see Drom Marav in English?
Southwest.
Southwest, right. That's what the rabbis refer to as Surya.
So is that geographically?
The Golan Heights, and the area around the Golan Heights,
uh-huh.
is Surya. You're allowed to raise sheep there. and goats, and also in the Midbarot of Eretz Yisrael. Now today when we say Midbar, we translate it as
desert.
But there are different types of deserts.
Right.
I'll just point out that Rav Steinsaltz, in his edition of the Gemara, the Talmud, writes that when the rabbis use the word desert, they don't mean the Sahara Desert. They don't mean deserts that have nothing in them. They mean the deserts of Eretz Yisrael, which are unpopulated, the Negev and Midbar Yehuda, the Judean desert, which is unpopulated. The rainfall is sparse. There are no springs of water, or not many springs of water, so you can't do much agriculture there. But it doesn't mean that it's an empty, howling yeshimon. Yeshimon is the word in Hebrew for a real, real, empty, desolate desert. It's not a yeshimon. And the truth is that even today you drive through Midbar Yehuda, the Judean desert, in the spring.
It's gorgeous.
It's gorgeous. It's all green, right? There's a lot of growth there that lasts only a month or two, and then it's gone. In a real desert, of course, you couldn't raise sheep, but in Midbar Yehuda you can, as you can in the Negev.
What's the big difference between raising sheep and raising cows that they created that?
We'll get to it. Okay. Absolutely, good question. Right, the whole question here: why is there such an isur? Why is there prohibition of raising a Beima Daka in Eretz Yisrael? We'll leave that for a little bit later. Let me look at the questions I have here. Okay, the truth is that's my next question. Oh. Why do you think it would be forbidden to raise Beima Daka? So what's the answer, or possible answer?
Probably it interferes with Darkei Shalom in some way. But what? About why does the cow not interfere? And I know that there's always an argument between the shepherds and the cowboys. Basically,
but here at least it's the farmer and the
farmer and the, yeah.
Okay, right.
Yeah, but I'm not clear what separates the cows from the Beima Daka.
Good question. So
except the figure.
Let's put that aside for a second. But at the basic point is that the tzon in their grazing ruined the land. In two senses. One is that they just eat everything available, and then the land basically becomes...
Wait, that's good. It's not land.
Sit down.
That's goats, not land.
But
no distinction. They both, sheep and goats, graze in the same fashion. They just eat everything available and leave nothing.
Yeah, like there was an idiot in the show where this goat has gone crazy when the farmer brings him to the city and he eats dynamite that they're using to blow... an old highway so they can make a new one.
That wouldn't be a good idea for...
I know that the Arabs, before the settlement of Israel, were overgrazing and it created a great depletion of the soil.
Yeah. Yeah.
But don't the cows do that?
Okay, so I understand. That's an issue. Why are cows different? But let's just make the point. Number one, we're talking about grazing and depleting the soil, and secondly, we're talking about grazing on other people's land.
Right.
When we're in a period when homesteads were not marked with fences, so it was very, very easy, and it was very, very
common
for the goats and the sheep to graze on land owned by someone else and planted by someone else, and that simply ruins the crops. So therefore, we have to go further. If the rabbis are saying that one shouldn't raise Beima Daka in Eretz Yisrael, Shalom Mary Beth, we're involved in an effort here to save the land of Israel, and not only save the land of Israel that it won't be depleted, but to save the farmers, to allow the farmers to do what they're doing and not feel threatened and not be threatened by the sheep and goat grazers. Later we'll talk historically what period are we talking about and what conflict is going on here. Yoni.
But isn't cow grazing good for the environment, since when they eat it they don't eat the seeds and when they step it into the earth?
Cows as opposed to goats and sheep, you're saying?
Yeah, so is that why they can stay?
I don't know, but that's not the answer given in the sources that we'll see in another few minutes. Oh. Okay, so why don't we go on? The next question I have to help us go forward and understand the Mishnah, what do you think could be the meaning of Mipnei HaKodeshim? So it had said that Ein Megadlim Tarnagolim B'Yishalayim Mipnei HaKodeshim. And we're asking, so what does that mean? So the Kodeshim.
Korbanot.
The Kodeshim are Korbanot. There are different types of korbanot, many different types. The one basic distinction is between kodeshim kalim and kodeshim hamurim. Kodeshim hamurim have to be eaten in the Beit Midrash, where kodeshim kalim can be eaten in all of Yerushalayim. For example, shlamim, korban shlamim, is eaten by the Baalim, eaten by the people who bring it. A little bit goes to the Mizbeach, to the altar, a little bit goes to the Kohanim, to the priests. Most of it is eaten as a meal by the person who brought it. It could be eaten in Yerushalayim, all of Yerushalayim, not beyond Yerushalayim. And think of the Korban Pesach. It's in that same category. It's brought in the Beit Mikdash, a little bit goes to the altar, to the Kohanim, but the vast majority is eaten by the Baalim, by the owners of it, within the confines of Yerushalayim. So Yerushalayim is a city in which many, many people are eating Kodeshim, are eating Korbanot, at different times of the year, not just on the holidays. Whenever people come and bring Korbanot, could be any day of the year that's not Shabbat. So they're bringing many, many Korbanot. They're eating them in the city. We have to be careful because the Kodeshim have to be eaten bi tahara, in purity. So the people go to the mikveh, they have to be pure. And, okay, so Anne, what's the problem with tarnagolim? What's the problem with chickens?
The manure?
What?
No.
Eggs. The noise?
The noise? No. The problem with chickens is that they carry scraps one place to another. Mm-hmm. And we're afraid that they would have gone digging in a place that had something that was tameh, like a little piece of basar tameh, of meat that was tameh, and they bring it all different places, and then the people who have to be tahor, to be pure, to eat their kodeshim, can inadvertently become tameh because the chickens brought something tameh into a place we didn't know that was there.
But raising chickens as domestic animals, you could limit where they go.
Good point. We'll see, actually mention that later. The assumption seems to be that the normal raising of chickens is not like today. They just are all over the place. Now, I remember when I was a long time ago, when I was 18, I spent time on a moshav near Yerushalayim, and the chickens just ran around in the courtyard free.
Right? It's supposed to be healthier.
For the chickens.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's not a good idea if you want the place to remain tahor. And then the Mishnah goes on to say, "V'lo kohanim be'eretz Yisrael." And as we said earlier, it doesn't mean you're not allowed to raise kohanim, rather the kohanim are not allowed to raise chickens, not just in Yerushalayim, but in all of Eretz Yisrael. And why would that be?
Because of the dirt. I mean, they're supposed to always eat clean,
right?
And they cannot have chickens wandering in and out.
Right. Norma people don't have to be, non-Kohanim don't have to be Tahor, except in Yerushalayim when they come to eat Korbanot. But Kohanim are eating Truma, for example, grain and fruits and vegetables that is holy, that has to be eaten by the Kohanim in Tahara, in purity. And if you have Tarnagolim walking around, they might cause impurity to be transferred from one place to another.
But a Kohen can never be impure.
Say it again?
The Kohen can never be impure, so...
Never be impure.
Halachically, the Kohen is not allowed, right? You're not allowed to allow himself to become tamei. That's why even today, Kohenim don't go into graveyards.
But why is it just in Eretz Israel? Why isn't it...
Okay, so Jeremy gets the prize because I was saying to myself just an hour ago, I wonder if someone's going to ask me that question.
Because the priests are only serving in the temple, and the temple's in Jerusalem.
So then why should, for your answer, why then should it say not, why shouldn't it just say that they can't in Jerusalem? It's saying they can't
they
in all of the land
of
Israel.
In another temple? Is there another
No, not in the temple, but the Kohanim can live throughout Eretz Yisrael. And they receive truma, they receive tithes right from their neighbors, and they have to eat them. They have to eat them in tahara.
It's probably Kohen's in Levitical cities, throughout the
Eretz Yisrael. But not just in Levitical cities. In every city in Eretz Yisrael, you're going to have some Kohanim. But there's no mitzvah to tithe your fruits and vegetables and give the produce that's been tithed and give the tithe to the Kohanim except in Eretz Yisrael. So most normally a Kohanim outside of Eretz Yisrael don't have any truma to eat. I'm not sure, but I guess if they did have truma to eat, they'd have to eat it b'tohara.
Wait a minute. So if they're outside of
outside of Israel.
They have no income.
What are they doing there? Do they eat? Have to get a job. What do they eat?
They have to get
the same thing that you and I eat.
I don't understand.
So they can eat anything outside.
Kohanim can always Kohanim are allowed to eat. Listen for a minute. Kohanim are allowed to eat normal food.
Can they eat meat?
And they don't have to eat it b'tohara.
Can they eat meat?
Yeah, they can eat anything. Meat that is not holy, that's not kadosh, doesn't have to be tahor and doesn't have to be eaten b'tahara. But if you have something that's sanctified, trumot, the tithe that's taken from vegetables and given to the kohenim, that has to be eaten b'tahara. But there's no mitzvah to tithe your vegetables outside of Eretz Yisrael. So the kohenim are not eating tithes and outside of Eretz Yisrael. They're eating normal food, only normal food, and therefore they don't have to be that careful about tahara, unless, of course, someone would bring them from Eretz Yisrael some truma that they'd have to eat. I assume b'tahara.
But they still keep the forbidding mitzvah not to go to the graveyard out of Israel.
Correct. The kohen is not allowed to put himself into a situation in which he becomes impure. But eating normal food doesn't make you impure.
Right.
Only eating holy food that's become impure makes you impure.
Okay, okay? So eating b'tahara, what is that?
Eating b'tahara means eating food that's holy and tahor when your body is in a state of tahara because you have gone to the mikveh and you've had the afer, the paradama sprinkled on you.
How does the food become pure?
If we're talking about shuma, for example, so I am a normal Jew in Israel, I have a pardes, I have an orchard, I give my certain percentage, take out my certain percentage, and I designate this as ma'aser, as the tithe, to the Kohen, let's say, or truma, also as a gift to the Kohen, and the food that I have made into truma has to be kept out of contact with something that's tameh.
Okay. Until the priest eats it.
And then the priest has to eat it when he himself has not had contact with something tameh. So the priest has to be tahor, the food has to be tahor. That's what's called eating kodshim b'tahara, or eating truma b', in a state of tahara.
So you don't wash the food. You
don't wash the food.
That's not part of it. You just have to keep it separate.
Keep it out of contact with tumah.
Yeah, okay. Got it. Thank you.
Next year you ought to give a class about Torah and tumah.
I'd have to do a lot of preparation because every time I learn this stuff, it just goes in one ear and out the other.
Yeah, mine too. That's why I was hoping you went straight.
Okay, so let's go on. The next matter going through the Mishnah is about chazirim.
Yeah,
pigs. Right? We're not allowed to raise pigs b'chol makom. In other words, not just in Jerusalem is it forbidden, not just in Eretz Yisrael, but b'chol makom, in every place. Even in Dallas, you can't raise pigs. And the question would be, as for example, I asked in the sheet in question number 6, why do you think that one should not raise chazirim?
Because you're not allowed to eat them.
Right, so you can't do anything with it. You can't eat it. That brings us to the question, why can't I raise pigs to sell them?
Oh, because you're not allowed to sell non-kosher meat.
And that brings us to the question,
really?
Good. Are you not allowed to sell
non-kosher
meat?
Sure.
If I'm the owner of Walmart, I can't have a butcher shop in my place. I can't buy shares in McDonald's.
Not supposed to benefit off of non-kosher food.
So here we come to a question. So Jeremy is revealing now the tip of an iceberg. Jeremy once asked me a question, which was, you want to tell them what the question was?
Yeah, I used to work as a waiter at a Trafe restaurant.
I remember.
When I became religious and when I did my conversion and everything, the Rav and I had to figure out if I needed to quit that job in order to convert, because was there a halachic problem with serving trade? And
getting benefit from it by getting a salary.
And getting benefit from it, right? So the answer was that it was okay, except in cases of basar v'chalav, I think. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, I had to just make sure that I wasn't serving Jews their basar v'chalav, which was not, which was shaky too.
Ask.
Well, what really killed me was the people. No, what really killed me were the guys who. Because I still wore my kippah there, because I didn't see any problem with that.
That's a nice way to
It's good, except if the guys that see you with the kippah start speaking Hebrew to you as they're ordering their tray, then it makes you feel
So, just to clarify.
In a kosher plant, if something is a meat plant, if something is found, some animal part is found to be not kosher, it is sold.
Good.
Yeah. Good.
That's right.
Good.
So,
good. The Nevelah.
Good. So in other words, what Jeremy's saying is, and it fits in with what Ilan and Lan just said, non-kosher meat.
Yeah.
A Jew is not allowed to eat, but a Jew is allowed to get benefit from it. Mm-hmm. Which means you can sell it and make a profit. So Jeremy, if he's serving non-kosher meat to non-Jews and getting the benefit of a salary from it, that's fine.
Yes.
If he's serving it to Jews, that's a problem because he's putting a stumbling block in front of the blind. He's aiding an avera. That's a different prohibition. But as long as there's no Jews coming to Texas land and cattle, off 75, if Jeremy's only serving non-kosher meat, then he can make a living off of that. Mm-hmm. But so concerning basar b'chalav, meat and milk, there's a special prohibition because it's written three times in the Torah, Lo tevashel gadi bechalev imo, you shouldn't cook a calf in its mother's milk three times. It says in the Torah, therefore the rabbi said there are three different prohibitions. One is to cook it, you can't do. One is to eat it, you can't do. And one is to get benefit of it, you can't do. Oh. So if Texas land and cattle serve cheeseburgers, Jeremy would have to make sure the salary doesn't come from serving cheeseburgers, but only from serving the...
So in short, you had to quit.
Very quiet.
You didn't quit?
No. Because...
And actually, there was another complication, because if the cheeseburgers are made with non-kosher meat, which they are, there's really no prohibition of basar v'chalav. The prohibition of basar v'chalav is only with kosher meat.
Oh.
It gets, anyway, back to our subject.
It was all treif anyway, so it didn't matter.
Right. So our subject here, raising pigs.
Mm-hmm.
Let me just finish. So there doesn't seem to be a prohibition against getting benefit from pigs in general, and therefore we ask, why is it forbidden to raise pigs? Yeah.
Does this also include other non-kosher animals?
Very good question. We're going to see a machloket among the Rishonim on that question. So we'll have to ask here, what is the problem? What's the prohibition? What's the issue?
Pigs,
and secondly, is it only pigs or is it all unkosher animals?
What if you own a petting zoo? So that's your...
And you raise pigs in your petting zoo, I understand. Well, according to the Mishnah, you better sell your petting zoo.
Or at least the pig.
Or better sell the pig.
Back then, they probably didn't have petting zoos.
But of course, we can go to a petting zoo. We'll spend more time and read further, and there might be more complications and details and interpretations.
Yeah. Well, pigs have more value than just eating them. I think they also clean up and...
Pigs have more value other than just eating them, right? For example, their fat. A lot of things are made from their fat, but we don't eat. And if we just said you're allowed to get benefit, so what's the problem?
And skin. Mm-hmm.
Their skin, their fat.
And football.
Yeah.
Okay, so we're just listing questions here.
Really,
let's see. Going further on in the Mishnah, there was the matter of the dog, raising a dog is forbidden unless you chain it up. We have to talk about that later.
So is it because the pigs walk back and forth and carry filth?
No, it doesn't say. We're not exactly sure. And what's wrong with filth?
Well, we have the chickens.
Pigs like chickens. I didn't see any discussion of that. Okay. I guess even in these times, if they did raise pigs, they did it in an enclosure, not like chickens that just go all over the place.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit before we go deeper into the matter of the yonim, the pigeons. Like the last halakha says, "Ein porsim nishbim liyonim." We do not spread out nets or traps for yonim, for pigeons, except if you are 4 miles from, 4 kilometers from the nearest settlement. Why?
Because it could hurt someone.
The trap could hurt someone?
Yeah.
Okay.
And also, didn't they send yonim out as for messengers and things like that?
And therefore?
As well? So you don't want to catch those messenger pigeons. It could be that it's a very important message that you just caught.
Good, good. Not just the messengers, but the fact is that some pigeons are wild and some pigeons are domesticated. Mm-hmm. And if you would catch a domesticated pigeon, what did you just do?
You stole someone's pigeon, right?
You just stole someone's pigeon. Okay. So the problem here is one of geneva. Let's now look at the questions beginning with 8. Something about the structure of the Mishnah. So question number 8. And this is going to require some concentration. Which halakha... Do you have the questions?
No.
You don't have the questions. Goodness gracious, great balls of fire.
Well, I can come sit beside you. I have the questions.
You did get it because you responded to it. You were the only person that responded.
I responded to you, but there was an attachment, wasn't there?
Okay, so Mary
Beth. But my computer guy's coming out, so we'll get it.
Okay. It'll be too late, but now we're
going to
look at number 8.
Were we supposed to respond?
No, but I always feel better when people respond.
Oh, okay.
Okay, let's do the questions. Question 8. Which halakha in this Mishnah is linguistically different from all the others in the Mishnah?
I found it.
Okay, then Lan knows it, but don't tell her.
I'm not going to spoil it.
Thank you.
Lo Yigadel?
Right. You notice that? Lo Yigadel.
Versus Ein.
Right.
Ein Gudlim.
All of them are Ein Migadlim, whereas one of them is Lo Yigadel. I'm not saying that has any meaning. It means the same thing, but we do ask ourselves, why does the language change? Let's put that in our back pocket for a minute and go on to the next question. Next question is as follows. How is the halakha that is linguistically different from the others, nevertheless linguistically identical to one of the others? It really sounds like a contradiction in terms, but it's not.
Well, negative, low, ain.
You're right, but more than
and
that.
It's klali.
You're right.
It's pretty much general.
Let me give you a hint to go further. When I say the halakha that's linguistically different than all the others, I mean the whole sentence. Lo yigadel adam et hakelev, elaim kein hayak kashor b'shal shelet.
There's a qualifier. I mean, you don't need. Right. You shouldn't do this except in said circumstance where you can. And so it's the last two, right?
The last two both have qualifiers. Elaim kein. So that's it. The matter of lo yigadel adam et hakelev. That part of it is linguistically sui generis, unique in this Mishnah, but the second part of it, Elim Kain, that connects it to the last halakha in the Mishnah, which is also a matter of Elim Kain, except if such. So we see a connection there. Let's go on to the next question, which is 10. Which case in this Mishnah is halachically most related to this chapter? And why do you say that?
Because the whole chapter is about Behemah.
Okay, that's...
Or the whole tractate, practically.
Okay, that's true. But now I'm going to make a distinction between halachically related and associatively related. It's true that the Masechet and the chapters talked a lot about Behemah Daka, but halachically, what's discussed about the Behemah Daka in this Mishnah is not at all similar to what's been discussed in the rest of this chapter concerning Behemah Daka. But there's another part of today's Mishnah that is exactly on the same halachic subject as the whole rest of the chapter. No. Ilana got it.
Yeah, it was stealing.
Stealing, right?
Who stole it? What are you talking about?
we don't set out traps for pigeons, is lest I trap some pigeon that belongs to you.
Oh, okay.
And that's exactly the subject of this chapter. This chapter is about stealing other people's animals.
Right.
So now we've discovered that most probably what ties Mishnah Zion, today's Mishnah, into this chapter is the matter of the pigeons. Even though, at first glance, you would have said what Lan said, that what ties this Mishnah into the chapter is the Beimat Daka. But that's associatively true, but halachically, the connection is the pigeons, because it's about stealing other people's animals. But the question, but the answer that Lan gave about the Beimat Daka, that's the answer to question 11. What is the associative, not halachic, connection of this Mishnah to the chapter? Right?
He was ahead of us.
Yeah. In other words, associatively, the chapter talked about stealing which animals, remember?
Sheep.
Sheep and...
chickens.
Goats. The whole chapter was about goats.
Right. Let's go back to the beginning of the chapter. Remember, there was a verse there at the beginning of the chapter. This is Perek Shvi, the seventh chapter, the first Mishnah. And in the Show second part, right, the verse was quoted, right? Ki ignov ishur ose. If a man will steal an ox or a sheep. And the chapter is all about stealing oxen or sheep. You pay, remember, four or five times. So when we talk at the end of the chapter, the beginning of Mishnah 7, that you're not supposed to raise a Beimat Daka, sheep or goats in Eretz Yisrael, associatively, that was the matter of the whole chapter. Associatively, but not halachically. Halachically, it's the pigeons that connects us to the chapter, but associatively, it is the Beimat Daka that connects us to the chapter. So we see there are two levels of connection of this Mishnah to the whole chapter. Let's do question 12 now. Which case or cases in this Mishnah is not related to the chapter, but rather to different chapters of the tractate?
Great.
That's and then you're going to want to know which
that's
chapter.
The Kelev, right? The Kelev, right? And not just the Kelev.
The
Tarnagulim, right? The chickens. Oh, right. What's the connection between not raising chickens, which is an issue of purity and impurity? What does that have to do with this chapter? This chapter is about stealing animals.
That's true.
And the truth is, the matter of the chickens is not only unrelated to the chapter, it's actually unrelated to the whole Masechet.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.
This Masechet is not talking about Tuman Tara, but purity and impurity, right?
Yeah, well, it relates to the other phrases in here.
Right.
They do that all the time.
Exactly. Linguistically, right, the matter of the chickens got into this Mishnah because it's a matter of Ein Migadlim. We don't raise. But the reason we don't raise chickens has nothing to do not with this chapter, not with this tractate. It's just there for the linguistic association.
So were they having like a long, like, or little piece of scraps of paper, or just they had these things loose and they're like pulling them and sorting them into...
Right.
I think the whole Mishnah Zayin was one chunk. And since they needed to use some of it, they put the whole chunk.
That's very possible. In other words, there were braitot. A braita is a collection of Tannaitic material. There were braitot that were organized sometimes not thematically at all, but only linguistically. In other words, there are braitot that say there are three things that, and there are all different types of topics dealing with stealing, dealing with human life, dealing with Tuman Tara. What connects them all is the wording, there are three things. Three things in this category, three things in this, three, because it's linguistically tied. And Ilana says perhaps this Mishnah was once a braita, was once a set of material that was organized linguistically, Ein Migadlim, Ein Migadlim, Ein Migadlim, and then it was put here in this chapter because part of it has some connection. That's one possible way of looking at it.
And they were under quite a big constraint of time at the time, right? Mm-hmm. Because things were disappearing, scholars were disappearing, and material was about to disappear. So whatever they could treasure and store together.
And right, it rolls off the tongue nicely. It. That way it's easier to remember.
Just remember, right? We have to keep in mind, it's a oral culture.
And
it's What's easy to remember? Okay, let's look at the 12a. Which of the Avot Nizikim does it or do they relate to? As we said, the material, we're talking material in this Mishnah that's not related halachically to the Mishnah, but is just here, perhaps for linguistic reasons. What Avot Nizikim, what categories of damages does it relate to?
Adama Mazik.
No.
What are Avot Nizikim?
Say it again, please.
What are Avot Nizikim?
We have Shein, Regel, Keren. Bor. Let's just remember that, right? Bor, right? Eish, and Adama Mazik. But if you weren't here, of course, we've been doing this for the past 2 years.
I see. I was like, man, last month y'all got a lot done.
The past 2 years, at least, if not longer. So let's point out that the matter of Ein Megadlin Bema Daka, right? We said is associatively related to the chapter, but not halachically. Halachically, it relates to earlier chapters. If we said we don't raise sheep or goats in Eretz Yisrael because they walk onto other people's property and trample and eat, well, that's exactly Shein Veregel that we discussed in many earlier chapters, right? It's related to the Masechet. It's not related to the chapter in a halachic sense. And then there was the matter of the Kelev.
But Beima Gasa doesn't trample in it?
Again, you said that earlier, and it's in the sources here that we'll get to, hopefully. Okay. Let's do 12b. The Tarnagolim, we said, have no connection.
Yeah.
They're just linguistically tied in here. But halachically, they're not connected to anything
in
this Masechet.
And
oh, so the Kelev, you're afraid that the Kelev might go and bite someone, which is not Shein.
Although he bites.
Right? A biting dog, is it Shein? Is it regular? Is it Karen?
Yeah, Karen.
It's Karen, right? If your dog bites, it's Karen. Because what is Karen? Karen is a
malicious.
Is a malicious, violent, out of the ordinary act of an animal that causes damage. It's not Shein, the regular, it's Karen. So the Kelev thing really is related to Tashur Hamazik with his Karen.
Kelev Hamazik. But they want they are much more severe on the dog than on the shore. The shore Mazik you have to supervise very carefully. But if it's not Mazik, you kind of assume he's okay. Here the dog has to be chained all the time.
Good point. Mm-hmm. Right?
Poor
because
dog.
The assumption is that a shore doesn't run wild usually.
Yeah.
Whereas a dog, if you don't chain it down, it runs around. Now remember, the dogs of then are not the dogs of today. The dogs of then were closer to what we call wolves. They were domesticated, but they weren't at the high level of domestication that we see today. Dogs like the dogs of the Mishnah you see roaming around the fields where I live today. Those are real dogs.
Really?
Yeah. Whoa. They're real dogs. My wife's not afraid of them. I am.
They can tell when you're afraid.
Yeah.
Don't worry, they bite either way.
I mean, I think both existed. They're wild dogs, but at least from the numbers that I've seen, the domesticated dogs have been around for.
Yeah, but I think that 50,000
years.
Not domesticated to the point of domestication we have today. They didn't have poodles.
That's breeding for. Domesticated in the sense of travels with, lives with human beings versus being bred for
specific,
Westminster kennel
club. Seth, you know much more than I do. I am just assuming that the degree of docility, if there's such a word, that can be found in some breeds of dogs today didn't exist to that degree then.
Yeah, I don't think
wrong.
No, these are, it's a fairly modern phenomenon.
But
versus a dog that lives in your house.
Yeah, I'm sure they had that. But those dogs barked and they ran.
Right, they didn't wear ribbons and get carried around. Yeah.
Okay, let me just point out question 12b, in which Mishnah, of which chapter of the tractate have we earlier seen mention of preventing damage by tying up an animal with some type of leash or rope? We have seen it.
Something about a fire where you tie dogs.
was a fire.
Oh, right. We had a dog that stole a cake that had a coal stuck to it.
Yeah.
But that wasn't about tying the dog up. The tying up of a shore, we saw at the very end of chapter Dalet, the fourth chapter. I guess you don't have the fourth chapter there.
No.
It begins with the fifth chapter. At the very, very end of the fourth chapter, the last Mishnah. Let me just read the last Mishnah of the fourth chapter. It is Mishnah Tet. Masaro the Shomer Chinam the Shoel. We're talking here about an ox that you hand it over to a guard or to a lender, a lendee. Lenosei Sachar le Socher, or to someone who is renting your ox out. Or to someone who was, someone who was paying for it. Nichnasu tachat ha'ba'alim. The guardian now plays the role of the owner as far as watching it. That's not our subject. Moed mishalem nezek shalem, v'tam mishalem chatzi nezek. Skip that. Here's the line that's important for us. Kasharo va'ala v'mosera. If its owner tied it with a rope. V'na'al b'feneya karu, or he locked it up properly. V'yatzav yizik, but it nevertheless went forth and damaged, etc. The law. Mm-hmm. Anyway, you see, so there is a discussion of the fact that if you tied up your ox, you did the shmira that's necessary.
Except Rabbi Eliezer.
Right, there's a machloka there I'm not going to go into. But it does seem that as far as dogs, it's not enough to put them in a corral. It has to be tied up with a leash. Okay, I want to, of course, we just scratched the surface. We didn't even begin yet. That's just getting to see what the basic words mean and the structure. Let's talk a little bit more of the structure before I actually get into the meat of the Mishnah. This is questions 14, 15, and 16. How is the form of all the halachot in this Mishnah fundamentally different from just about anything else we've seen in this tractate?
Well, I would guess, because it's the whole ain thing.
And how is it different from the rest of the tractate?
Well, the other ones give you situations that say, if this happened, then you have to do this. But here, it's, this is just not done. This is just
right?
not done.
Right, 100%. The difference is between lahatkhila
B'diavad,
right? Lahatchila, to begin with, what are you supposed to be doing? Our Mishnah tells you what you're supposed to do. The rest of the whole tractate doesn't tell you what to do. It tells you what happens if you did.
Right.
How much you have to pay? Are you responsible? Are you negligent? Right. So this Mishnah is really very different than anything we've seen until now, which gives us the impression, going back to things Ilana said earlier, it's probably taken from a different source and put in here because it more or less fits. Let's think about this more or less fits, which is questions
also
15 and 16.
Wise, it is shaped like a complete unit.
What do you mean by that?
The Mishnah itself. Mishnah Zayin has a structure that you can see that it is authentic of that group. It doesn't have the structure that the other Mishnayot have.
Oh, you mean it's different shape than the other?
Yes.
It's different.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's all ain.
Yes.
And that one low. So anyway, questions 15 and 16. Take a broad overview of the first six chapters of the tractate. Right? They're all talking about damages that your animals or your possessions do. You're sure, or your seh, or your boar, your animals, your possessions cause damage. Think of the subject of this chapter, which was all about stealing animals.
Yeah.
And look at the first two words of the next chapter.
Oh, it's a different thing.
Ha-hovel b'chaviro. Someone who hurts his fellow.
So in other words, direct.
Right. Chapter 8 begins Adam HaMazik.
Yeah.
A man who hurts another man. The earlier chapters of this tractate were all about indirect, your animals causing damage, or your possessions, your kad, right, your jug, or your boar, your hole causing damage. And then in the middle of that, was stealing. Right? The first six chapters are damages. The seventh is stealing animals, a human being stealing animals. And the eighth brings us to a human being actually going and punching someone into the nose. And given that progression of different subjects, we now see our Mishnah here at the end of chapter Zion. We ask ourselves, why is it here? So the easiest thing that we can say is that this Mishnah that's about animals, human beings raising animals,
mm-hmm.
is tacked on to the end of the part of the
animals.
Tractate that talks about animals. From this point down, it's not going to talk about animals anymore. It's going to talk about human beings.
Okay.
Again, the first six chapters talk about my animals doing damage. The seventh chapter talking about stealing animals. And then from this point on, the Mishnah is going to talk about the whole tractate, 8, 9, etc. is going to talk about human beings causing damage to other human beings. If you have something to say about animals that you haven't said yet in the first seven chapters, this is the place to tack it on.
Right.
And it fits again because of the yonim. It does fit into the stealing.
Right.
And the yonim are about ein.
Right.
So all these other things about animals, about ein, are also brought in by the way. Perhaps again, as Ilana said, it was part of the same unit. If you bring in the ein porcin, the traps of the yonim, so you bring in the rest of the stuff, it's about animals, and it more or less fits. Okay, now with that introduction, we can actually start learning the deeper stuff in the commentaries.
Good.
Ready. Okay. So, let's look on the first page that you have in front of you.
Mm-hmm.
At the bottom of the page, it says Rashi Masechet Bava Kama Daf Ayin Tet Amud Bet. Rashi's commentary on our Mishnah. And I think that the only thing that we have to look at in Rashi is the first Rashi. This is going to be interesting. The first Rashi there is on the opening words, the Dibur Matchil, Ein Migadlin Beima Daka Be'eretz Yisrael. We don't raise sheep or goats in Eretz Yisrael. And says, why don't we have Jeremy read it? What Rashi says.
Okay, Mishum Yeshuv Eretz Yisrael Shem Mavir Et Sedot
Sedot
Sedot Ve'chol Sedot Eretz Yisrael Staman D'Yisrael.
Fantastic. Let's try and figure out what it means. Want to give it a shot?
Because the settling of Eretz Yisrael, Shemimavir. All
right, so that's a hard word. It actually comes from the Torah. It means to...
set a fire, no?
No, it means... I understand why you're saying that. It also could mean that in modern Hebrew. It means to graze harshly, to destroy through grazing.
Okay.
Oh, okay.
Okay, Shemavil, they destroy the grasses or the
fields.
Fields. Okay, and all the fields of Eretz Yisrael are considered Yisrael.
Yeah, that's a good translation. So that's what Rashi says. We don't raise sheep or goats in Eretz Yisrael because of the matter of Yishuv Eretz Yisrael, because of the settling of the land, the settlement of the land. That the animals destroy the fields, and all the fields are considered to be of Israel, belonging to Israel. Okay, so now what did Rashi say? It's not so clear what he said. So in the end, what's the reason why we don't raise Beima Daka near to Israel? Because, okay, Ilana says because of the mitzvah of Yishuv Eretz Yisrael.
Mm-hmm.
That makes sense. Could you be more specific?
To me, it was a nice revelation because I thought it was kind of a Zionist invention, and now okay. I find it in Baba Kama with Rashi.
Okay.
So apparently, the mitzvah to settle Israel is an old mitzvah.
Yeah, it's a mitzvah in the Torah, absolutely. So, but now again, the question: so why shouldn't I raise Beima Daka Eretz Yisrael? What does it have to do with the mitzvah of Yishuv Eretz Yisrael?
Because they're almost undoing the settlement of Israel because
right.
You're broadening the fields and raising crops and trying to make the land of Israel livable and to settle it, and the Dakot are going around unsettling things, like destroying things, making it where the crops can't be grown, and they're like reversing the settlement good. Of the land.
Right. Good, good. And why does Rashi end with these last six words that say, "And all the fields of Eretz Yisrael are staman, are considered to be, or are usually of Yisrael"? Why is that important?
Because if it's not goyim, that there's no need to worry about it.
Okay, that's what it seems, right? Because Jews are settling the land, and like Jeremy said, the sheep and goats, they undo the settling of the Jews of the land. Therefore, we're not allowed to keep these animals because of the basic mitzvah of Yishuv Eretz Yisrael. That's what it seems to be saying.
Unless Rashi means that just implicitly the land of Israel belongs to Israel. Whoever owns the fields right now, it's still destroying the land of Israel that belongs to Israel.
Okay, very good. What Ilana said, we'll see actually is a machloket achronim. There's a disagreement among the late commentators how to understand the nuances of this Rashi. We'll come back to what Ilana said. You understand it. Everyone might not have heard her. We'll come back to it in just a few seconds. Let me just read while we're at it the second Rashi to broaden and complete the picture. The second Rashi, Aval Migadlin Besuria. But we raise them in Syria, right? Which is not part of the land of Canaan. And Rashi says, Aram Tzova. Aram Tzova is the traditional name of the city of Aleppo, which, by the way, has been in the news in the past few months. And Aleppo is in western Syria, right? Also, not just west, but southwestern, excuse me. So Aram Tzov is the name of the city, and it's used as a name for the whole area. That whole area of southwestern Syria, today southwestern Syria, is what we call Syria. And says Rashi, v'chutz la'aretz mutar legadel. Outside of the land, you're allowed to raise.
And that's regardless of who owns the
farm. Okay. Wait a second. The lo chayshinen lishuv, because we don't worry about settling it. There's no mitzvah to settle it. So we don't worry about the fact that the animals are causing issues for the settling of the land. But what Rashi adds is important. Vim yafsidu stot achirim yishalmena.
Oh.
And if they cause damage, you have to pay. In other words, no one says that in Syria you're allowed to allow your animals to graze in my fields. I'm sorry. Whether I'm Jewish or not, whether it's Eretz Yisrael or not, you can't send your animals to my field. And if you do, you'll have to pay. But we don't make a takana. We don't make a civil ordinance that says don't raise them. We let you take the risk. If you want to raise them, raise them. If you cause damage, you have to pay. But Eretz Yisrael, because of the mitzvah of Eretz Yisrael, not only do you have to pay if you damage, but we take steps to say don't damage. Don't raise the animals at all, so that we don't reach that situation of causing damage, because we're so concerned with strengthening the yeshuv of Eretz Yisrael.
Wow.
Good. Okay. And like I said a few minutes ago, we'll see that there's a bit of a machluk in how to understand the nuances of this Rashi. What time is it? How are we doing?
It's now quarter of three.
Quarter of three. Okay. Is it okay to continue, or do you want to take a break to eat more?
Why won't you eat? You didn't have lunch yet.
After. Okay. So why don't we look now on the second piece of paper, which has more sources that I brought. We can skip the first two sources. They're just for background. And we can read the third one. The third source there says Shulchan Aruch Hoshin Mishpat Siman Taf Tet Saif Aleph. Anyone want to read?
Is Hoshin Mishpat part of Shulchan Aruch?
Good question, yes.
Or interpretation to Shulchan Aruch?
The Shulchan Aruch has four parts. Four parts of the Shulchan Aruch. Let's see if we know. Jeremy, what's the first one?
Rabbi, don't test me on this.
No, you know.
I don't know.
The first part of the Shulchan Aruch?
Yeah, I don't even know.
Okay, the first part is Orach Chaim, right? Which is the basic laws of everyday life. Orach Chaim. And then you have Yorei Deah. Yorei Deah includes the laws like Nidah, like Kashrut, like Brit Milah, like Hilchot Girim is there. Mm-hmm. Most of the laws that concern us, if they're not in Orach Chaim, they're in Yorei Deah. And then you have two parts of the Shulchan Aruch that are not commonly studied today because they have to do with civil law. So you have Choshen Mishpat and you have Evin HaEzer. Evin HaEzer, for example, is laws of damages, Baba Kama, laws, relationships between neighbors, and Choshen Mishpat. The truth is, I don't know how to define well the difference between Choshen Mishpat and Evin HaEzer, to tell you the truth. But anyway, looking here at Choshen Mishpat, and the halacha and the Shulchan Aruch says as follows. Who wrote the Shulchan Aruch, by the way? Just make sure everyone knows. Right, Rav Yosef Karo. Ein migadlin beima daka be'eretz Yisrael. Mipenei shedarkam lir'ot b'sadot shel acherim. Ve'hezekam matsui. Translation. We don't raise sheep and goats in Eretz Yisrael because their way is, their custom is, to graze in the fields of others, and hezekam matsui, and they're causing damage is common. And that, of course, is pretty clear from the Mishnah, from the commentaries. And then he goes on to say, aval migadlim v'suya uv'midbarot shaber Eretz Yisrael, which is also from our Mishnah, but we can raise them in Suria and in the deserts of Eretz Yisrael. Fine. All that is pretty clear to us. There's nothing new or exciting there. But now he says, V'ha'idna, today, and let's know when is today. Rav Yosef Karo lives in Eretz Yisrael. He lives in Tzfat. Right? The year is about the year 1560. 1540, 1550, 1560 is when he wrote the Shulchan Aruch in Tzfat. And he says, V'ha'idna, today, She'ein matsui, Shiyu liYisrael be'eretz Yisrael sadot nira dishari. Translation, and today that it's not common, matsui, it's not common. Shiyu liYisrael be'eretz Yisrael sadot, it's not common that Jews in Eretz Yisrael will have fields. They weren't engaged in agriculture. Nira dishari. It appears that it's mutar. Shari means mutar, permitted.
Shari v'kayam.
No, it's that Sharir. Sharir.
Ah!
It's different. So, says the Shulchan Aruch, and I don't remember seeing earlier sources that he's based upon. It's his chidush, it's his interpretation. He says, in our time, if you want to be a shepherd in the fields of Tzfat, you can. Because there are no Jewish fields that you're going to cause any damage to. Okay, there are goyim that have sadot, and if you do damage, you have to pay. But there's no gzeirah, there's no takana, there's no civil ordinance that says you can't raise sheep. You can raise sheep and take the risk that you might cause damage and pay.
So he's in conflict with Rashi.
So that's not clear. No, that's not clear if he's in contact with
Depending
Rashi.
Depending how we read Rashi.
Well, the definition
Rashi's just
of
interpreting the text.
I mean, Rashi's interpreting the text.
He's not coming up with a psak halakha.
But from Rashi's interpretation, exactly. I would say that you can come to the interpretation of the Shulchan Aruch. Because what did Rashi say? The Rashi say that the whole matter of our prohibition of raising Beima Dakan Eretz Yisrael is because the fields belong to Jews, and we want to encourage Yishuv Eretz Yisrael, the setting of Eretz Yisrael, and if we raise our animals, it's going to cause damage, the farmers are going to be upset, and perhaps they'll even start selling their land. They won't be able to make a living. This is what Rashi seems to be saying. And therefore, for the sake of Yishuv Eretz Yisrael, the Jews settle on the land and stay in the land, we're going to forbid you from Beima Daka, from raising Beima Daka. Says the Shulchan Aruch, I understand that. And if so, in our time, the prohibition doesn't apply because there's no Jewish farmers that are going to be encroached upon. So you can certainly make a case that the Shulchan Aruch is actually basing itself upon Rashi's interpretation of the law of the Mishnah. Everyone with me?
Yes, sir.
Except.
If we read Rashi as a principle and not as a
right.
practical.
Right. Right. So let's. I said we're going to get back to. We'll get back to it. Let's read now the Gra. The next source is Biur HaGra. The Gra is an acronym for Gaon Rabbi Eliyahu. Right. The Gaon Rabbi Eliyahu. The Gaon Mivilna. We're talking about what year is this? The 1700s. Right. The 1700s. 1700s.
So he's commenting on Shulchan Aruch.
And he's commenting on the Shulchan Aruch. And he says the following: Vahaidna. In other words, he's looking at that word that the Shulchan Aruch used, Haidna, which means today in our times. And he says, Divrei Hamechaber, the words of the author, and that phrase "author" is the phrase we use to refer to the Shulchan Aruch, to Rav Yosef Karo. Divrei Hamechaber Sheze Lo Talya BeEretz Yisrael Rak BiShuv Yisrael. Translation: the words of the Shulchan Aruch are that this law, lo talya, it doesn't depend, it's not talui, to use modern Hebrew, it doesn't depend on Eretz Yisrael, but rather the settling of Yisrael. Yisrael means Jews. They're not the land of Israel, but the settling of Jews. And what he is hinting at is two things. Number one, that we were right until now, Lan was right, that the halacha, and Jeremy was right, we're all right, it's about the settlement of the land among Jews. And that's what Rashi said, and that's what the Shulchan Aruch is saying, and if there's no Jews who have fields, so that then the law doesn't apply. But he's also subtly hinting to us that things could have been understood differently. Because when he says it doesn't depend on Eretz Israel, but rather on the settlement of Jews, he's implying there's a certain way to read it that we're not reading it. We're not reading it as depending upon the land, but it's rather dependent on the people who settled the land. You hear from that, perhaps there's another interpretation, which is Ilana, who says it depends on the land and the law would apply even if there's no Jews there. Which brings us to the next source. The next source is Sefer Pat HaShulchan, or Pe'at HaShulchan, excuse me. The book Pe'at HaShulchan is analogous to the Mishnah Berurah. The Mishnah Berurah is a modern practical commentary on 1/4 of the Shulchan Aruch, or Achaim. The other three parts of the Shulchan Aruch, what happens if you want a modern practical commentary? So Pe'at HaShulchan is a modern practical commentary written just 100 years ago, perhaps 150, on those parts of the Shulchan Aruch that deal with the mitzvot hatluyot ba'aretz, the agricultural laws.
Who wrote it?
I don't remember.
Just on the agricultural laws?
Yeah. The laws of Trumot and Masrot, agricultural gifts of tithes, of leaving the corn of the field, all of those laws, which of course were not that much in usage for a good 1,500 years. So at the beginning of the return of the Jewish people to the land of Israel, we needed a guide. Here comes Sefer Pe'at HaShulchan.
And who wrote Mishnah Berurah?
Jeremy, who wrote the Mishnah Berurah?
Jeremy wrote Mishnah Berurah.
Don't quiz me.
You probably know. You know about the Mishnah Berurah?
Is that Isserlich? Isserlich or the Mappah?
Right.
This is Rav Yisrael Meir Kagan, the Chofetz Chaim, who lived in 1930.
The Chofetz Chaim,
yeah. So he was 20th
century. So
that's
very modern.
Yeah.
Yes.
And when did Isserlich write the Mappah?
Just one generation, at the same generation, one generation
right, yeah,
after the Shulchan Aruch.
So 1500, yes.
So that's not considered modern, because it's still old.
I'm not using the words in any technical sense here. So Sefer Pat HaShulchan, Pe'at HaShulchan, he's quoting a commentary on the agricultural laws from the Middle Ages. And I brought from that book, which is called Kaftor HaFerach, through the Sefer Pe'at HaShulchan, because I don't have Kaftor Torah Ferach at home, but I had the Pe'at HaShulchan, so I could just type it in. So he's quoting from this other book written in the 1500s, I think, as follows: Uvesefer Kaftor Uferach, Perach Yud, Inyan Kuf Pei'chet. That's what's written in this book, Kaftor Perach, chapter such and such, paragraph such and such, Hirich De gam bisman hazeh. He hirich, which means he spent, he lengthened himself. He spent a lot of time proving that gam bisman hazeh, that also in our day, bisman hazeh, in our time, she'ein eretz Yisrael biyadeinu, that the land of Israel is not in our hands, asur.
Aha, that's the
In other words, approach. Against the Shulchan Aruch.
That it's not allowed.
You're not allowed to raise Beima Daka, even when no Jews live in Eretz Yisrael.
Because it hurts the land.
Because it hurts the land.
Yes.
It
hurts the potential.
Right. So now, I say to Mary...
Or is it some psychic thing?
Right. I want to make it clear that this is not necessarily a mystical position. It could be, but it's not necessarily. He's just saying that sheep and goats damage the land. And I don't care if it's Jews who are farming there or non-Jews, but we have to have a certain degree of respect for Eretz Yisrael.
But who does this apply to? I mean, it's not...
So if there are Jewish people there who don't have land, but they might have sheep and goats, you're not allowed to raise sheep and goats in Eretz Yisrael, even if all the fields are owned by non-Jews.
And he proved right, because... When in 1882, when they started resettling Israel, the damage was tremendous of all the grazing. Israel was completely deforested.
But legally, this is just applying to Jews. So
right.
If there are no, he's talking about. So when he says Be'adeno, it means that it's not politically controlled by Jews.
Right.
But
what he means is that there's no Jews who have land there, who have farms there.
Mm-hmm.
That's what he really means.
Okay.
But the question is, when we have in the land of Israel, farms are not owned by Jews, does the prohibition of raising Beima Daka apply or not apply? The Shulchan says it doesn't apply.
But it still only applies to Jews, so you would have
the
to
prohibition.
Own these...
The prohibition.
Right, so I guess... If,
lease land from
right, if we were saying that the prohibition applies... And if Eretz Yisrael was politically in our hand, then we would prevent everyone from raising these animals because it causes damage to the land that we have great respect for. Right. So anyway, let's go on. I'm at the end of the first line here. Shaharei be'eretz Yisrael nesru elo hadinim. For behold, in the land of Israel were forbidden these things mitzad atzma. For its own sake, because of the land itself, not because of the Jewish farmers who are going to have difficulty, because the land itself has to be respected. Shehuz harnu behefseda, that we were warned against hefseda, we're warned against hurting the land. And again, it's not a mystical concept necessarily, it's simply that it, like Ilana said, deforests and destroys the land. Venitztavenu biyishuva. Kol Hayamim, and we were commanded in Yeshuva, in its settling. What he seems to mean is we have to always be careful not to make the land less settleable, because we're commanded to always make an effort to settle it. So even if we're not settling it right now, but we shouldn't do anything to push off the possibility of settlement. So even if it's not Jews who are living there now, but if we go and keep sheep and goats and deforest the land, then we're pushing off the possibility of ever resettling it ourselves. We're making it harder to resettle. And since of the mitzvah of Yishuv Eretz Yisrael, therefore this prohibition applies kol hayamim, all the days. You're never ever allowed to have sheep and goats in Eretz Yisrael. Ba'afal pi she'ein ha'aretz bi'adenu. And even though the land is not in our hands, what he means by that, even though we don't have any farms there, we're not hurting any Jews presently. Doesn't matter.
Rabbi, where is the source of Mitzvah Yishuv Eretz Yisrael?
The source is in Sefer Dvarim and in Sefer Shmot, where it says you should enter the land and settle it. For example. Right? Okay, so this gets, in my mind, pretty interesting. Of course, the question is going to be, and what happens when Yisrael comes back to Eretz Yisrael? What do we do with this prohibition in the 1890s, the 1900s, and the year 2013? Is there a prohibition today against raising Beima Daka in Eretz Yisrael or not?
And it's not
It's not regular cows. It's just sheep and goats.
Just sheep and goats. And Ilan had said earlier, what's the difference? We didn't get to that yet. But it's just sheep and goats.
And we talk so much about the Ro'eh v'Chalil.
Right. Like we said at the very beginning, the whole culture of the Tanakh is about the shepherd in Eretz Yisrael. And now we're saying you can't be a shepherd in Eretz Yisrael. Because you can't be a shepherd without sheep. Okay? So, we now have among the Achronim, the later authorities, a machloket, an argument concerning this mitzvah, I should say this prohibition of Beima Dakan Yisrael. According to the Shulchan Aruch, it doesn't apply today when there are no Jewish farmers in Eretz Yisrael. Whereas according to the book Kaftor Oferach and according to the Pe'at HaShulchan, it does apply even when there are no Jewish farmers in Eretz Yisrael. And now, each of these two approaches claims that they're based on Rashi.
Yes.
The question is, what did Rashi mean? Okay? So let's read on. The same source.
In 2013, when there are Jews in Israel, it should be halakha malakha.
We'll talk another 5 minutes. yeah. So anyway, says our source that we're reading now, the Path to Shulchan, we are in the third line, the second word of the line, which is vilazeh. Vilazeh peresh Rashi. And for this reason, Rashi interpreted, etc. In other words, he holds that Rashi is the source for understanding that this prohibition applies even when there's no Jewish farmers in Eretz Yisrael. Because Rashi wrote, and now we quote, Ein migadlin beima daka be'eretz Yisrael mishum yishuv Eretz Yisrael shemav irot et asadot bechol sadot Eretz Yisrael de Yisrael hen ayin sham. He just quoted Rashi, and I'm just going to translate what he quoted, but we've seen it before. Rashi says, we don't raise Beima Dakan Yisrael because of settling Eretz Yisrael, that they destroy the fields, and all the fields of Eretz Yisrael are of Jews. And Jeremy, of course, notices, because he read it earlier, that this quote of Rashi is missing a word.
Destaman.
Right. Our version of Rashi had said that all the fields of Eretz Yisrael are assumed to be, are considered to be, are usually of Jews. Whereas in the quote here, it just says all the fields are of Jews. And you wonder if it doesn't make a difference that he left out a word or not. Let's read on and see. Okay, so now, that was the end of the quote from this book, Kaftor Uferach. Mm-hmm. In other words, our source, Sefer Pe'at HaShulchan, in the 19th century, is quoting from Kaftor Oferach, written hundreds of years before that. And in Kaftor Oferach, he based his interpretation on Rashi. In other words, he says, you can see from Rashi, that the mitzvah is a mitzvah in Eretz Yisrael. And it doesn't matter if there's Jews there or not. The mitzvah is a yeshuv Eretz Yisrael, you're not allowed to hurt the land of Israel. And now our book, Pe'at HaShulchan, is going to say the following. I have a period there, which was the end of the quote. And now Pe'at HaShulchan says, Aval Rashi lefaneinu katav, but the Rashi in front of us writes differently, when we have a different version of Rashi. Staman d'Yisraelhen, end quote. We have those words, staman, that is considered to be a veritzel, usually a veritzel, mostly of Jews. Mash mabishum shayu asadot shel Yisrael. It sounds like it's because the sadot belong to Jews. Un mash makidivrei Shulchan Aruch. And it sounds like the words of the Shulchan Aruch. Which means the following. If Rashi says that the reason we have to have respect for the land is because most of the land is farmed by Jews, then it's not about respect for the land per se, it's a respect for the Jewish farmers of the land. Mm-hmm. Which would be the interpretation of the Shulchan Aruch, that in these days where there's no Jewish farmers, the prohibition doesn't apply. Mm-hmm. Whereas Kaftor Oferach, the book from hundreds of years before that, had a different version in Rashi. And Rashi's version didn't say because most of the fields belong to Jews. Rather, just said because the fields are of Jews. And the way Kaftor and Ferf interpreted it to mean because the land itself intrinsically belongs to Jews. Not the question of who's there now. Because it intrinsically belongs to Jews, therefore I have a need to respect it, and therefore the prohibition applies whether the Jews there or not. So it turns out that both positions, Kaftor or Ferach, and the Shulchan Aruch, can base themselves on Rashi, and perhaps just depends on one little word in Rashi. How do you interpret Rashi? It is a matter of respect for the land, because the land is mostly farmed by Jews, or is it respect for the land because the land is intrinsically a Jewish land? The nafkamina, the difference being, does the prohibition apply when there's no Jewish farmers? So, that's the question. And perhaps I'll change the order of the source a little bit. Why don't we look at the three modern sources I brought that deal with this question today? So, is there a prohibition today? Today I mean the beginning of the Zionist return to Eretz Yisrael, 1880 to the present. Does the prohibition apply? And of course, here there's two questions. The question is, did it apply when there weren't Jews there? And does it apply today when we have Jewish farmers again? Now you might say to yourself, wait a second, it's a no-brainer. Today that we have Jewish farmers again, of course the prohibition applies. Right. It doesn't even matter if it applied 200 years ago or not. If we hold like the Shulchan Aruch, or hold like the Kaftor or Ferach, in any case, today there's Jewish farmers again, of course it applies.
Well, shouldn't there be some notion that maybe there's different ways now to raise sheep?
Yes.
If you need sheep, if you just figure you need sheep there, you don't want to ship them or whatever?
Yes, that's exactly what we're about to read.
Okay.
So,
and you have a population that likes sheep. Sheep meat.
Oh, like shawarma, you mean?
Or yes. Like Australia, like in some places in Australia, there are more sheep than people.
Really?
Yeah.
So let's move now to the third piece of paper, the second half of the page. I have a dotted line there.
Okay, good.
And we have three modern halachic decisors talking about this halacha in modern times.
Oh, wow.
The first one is Rav Kook, right? Okay. It begins with an acronym, Harav Avram Yitzhak HaKohen. That's the acronym.
Oh.
Hey, Resh Aleph Yud Hey. Harav Avram Yitzhak HaKohen, Kook. Halacha Bruah. Halacha Bruah is an amazing project that Rav Kook undertook. Rav Kook undertook to write a halachic commentary on the whole Talmud.
Wow!
And I don't know if he finished it all. I know that only a small, small portion of what he did finish has been published in the present day. And what it is, they're publishing it today, it's a volume of the Talmud, and the end is a halachic summary of all the conclusions of the different passages. So in the Halacha Bruah on Bava Kamma, Rav Kook writes as follows. He writes, Lashon HaShulchan Aruch, the language of the Shulchan Aruch, who, I'm skipping what we have there in brackets, parentheses, Ein Migadlin Beima Daka Beretz Yisrael, Yipnei Shadarkam Lirot V'Sadot Acherim V'Ezikam Metzui, Aval Migadlin V'Suya V'Mid Barot Shaberetz Yisrael, V'Aitna She'ein Metzui She'el Yisrael Beretz Yisrael Sadot Nira D'Shari. That's a quote, word for word, from the Shulchan Aruch. I'll just translate again to help you. Translation. We don't raise Beima Daka in Eretz Yisrael because their way is to graze in the fields of others and them doing damage is common. But we raise them in Surya and in the deserts of Eretz Yisrael. Now the last word of the second line. Va'idna, today, that it's not found that Jews have fields in Eretz Yisrael, near Ad Shah, it appears that it's permitted. You're allowed to raise animals, so today, because Jews don't have farms there. And says Rav Kook, Uviyameinu, in our day, Shin Bete, Shebe Ezrat Hashem, that with God's help, Hitchil Yishuv Eretz Yisrael. I'm sorry, Yishuv Yisrael, Eretz Yisrael, has begun the settling of Jews in Eretz Yisrael near Apashut. It seems clear. Shasur, that it's forbidden. Bechol Merchav Makom Yishuv Kedin Mishnah. It appears that it's forbidden in all the areas of settling the land like the law of the Mishnah, says Rav Kook. Why should it be any different? Right? There's no question, Jewish fields, not Jewish fields. Today we do have Jewish fields. Back to the condition of the Mishnah, it should be forbidden. Says Rav Kook, this is in the very, very beginning of the 20th century. When you might say that the ways of raising sheep was the same it was for thousands of years, by free grazing. Rav Kook says, of course, we can't have sheep doing damage to our efforts to settle the land, raise crops. And now remember something very, very, very important. Extremely important. That a shepherd uses the land but doesn't make any claim to land because he's here today, gone tomorrow. Mm-hmm. The farmer makes a claim to land. He's there all the time. Because mm-hmm. if the land is being farmed, it's been possessed by the farmer. It's been claimed for the Jewish people, etc. Just like 2,000 years ago, when the rabbis were making their effort to prevent farmers from leaving Eretz Israel, prevent Jews from leaving Eretz Israel, they wanted farmers, because farmers hold on to land, they make a claim to land. Shepherds don't make a claim to the land. So the same thing says Rav Kook in 1900. We want Jewish farmers, we don't want shepherds. But as time goes on, the halachic interpretation changes. So now, look at Rav Avadya Yosef. It's, of course, fitting to study his words. He passed away just a month ago. Probably one of the greatest Talmidei Chachamim of the 20th century.
Were you at his funeral?
I was not at his funeral.
Wow.
Why was I not at his funeral? I was here. I think I was here in Dallas.
Oh.
So Rav Avadya has a tshuva on this. Excuse me.
More tea?
That was fine. The honey was very good. But tebeit einai lahagon mofet doenu moenu harav tzvi pesach frank shlita. Translation.
Kol hakavod that you can read all these Rashi Tevot.
And let our eyes be cast upon the great genius, the pride of the generation, our teacher, Rav Tzvi Pesach Frank Shlita, may he live a long life. He was the chief rabbi of Jerusalem going back 50 and 40 years ago, Rav Frank.
What is Shlita?
Shlita is the Aleph is Amen, the Ta Tet is Tovim, the Yud is Yamim.
Ah, she is Kelechaim Le Yamim.
Tovim Amen. No, Amen. She's Ke Le Yamim Tovim Amen. Something like that. Yamim
Arukim. Oh, so he's still alive.
He was still alive then.
Right.
When this was written.
Yeah.
When this was
written. I thought it was the title of Talmid Chacham. Because you see it a lot.
Oh, yeah.
Like one and a half Shlita. Oh. I thought, it's like a PhD.
Yeah. That's good.
It means that the Jewish people need some. We don't want them to die. So anyway, B'sefer Hartzvi, in his book, it's called Hartzvi, Shnit Pas B'sof Sifrei HaTorim, etc., that was printed at the end of Sifrei HaTorim. Now in the beginning of the second line, after the parentheses, after the comma, Shnishal B'din Zeh, that he was asked concerning this matter. Rav Frank was asked. It was being quoted by Rav Avadya Yosef. L'dati, said Rav Frank, Yesh ledun be'inyan ze lehetera. This is in the 1950s and 60s, I believe. And he said, in my opinion, we should consider this matter lehetera, for leniency. The language of heter. Consider it for leniency. In other words, that there should not anymore be a prohibition against raising these type of animals in Eretz Yisrael. Velomar, and we'll say, Shekevan shebemeshech hazman nitbatel ha'isor, that since during the course of time the prohibition was nullified, v'hutar legedel beimad daka beretz Yisrael, and it was permitted to raise Bema Daka in Eretz Yisrael? Why was it permitted? Because the Shulchan Aruch said it was permitted. There were no Jews having farms, so there's no prohibition to the Shulchan Aruch. So since it was once permitted, we will leave it permitted. Shuv Eina Davar Chozel Yisro. Again, the matter doesn't come back to prohibition. Ela Ayadei Minyan Chadash. Rather, only by way of a minyan hadash. A minyan hadash means a new sitting of the court.
Ah.
Minyan means judges who are have to be a certain number. Have to have a certain. A minyan hadash means a new court. I know it doesn't sound like that, but it means that's what it means. So he says, look, the gzerah, the prohibition, was cancelled because there were no Jewish farms there. And since it's been cancelled, we can't bring it back without a new decision to bring it back. Right, a new court. And we're not, the court is not sitting now, so there's no prohibition. V'chol zman shelo nigzar b'minyan chadash. And all the while that it hasn't been re-promulgated with a new court, hareyu k'gzeirah chadasha she'ein osim me'atzmeinu gzeirot chadashot. It would be like a new prohibition. We don't make new prohibitions on our own.
Lovely.
So that's his interpretation. It doesn't apply. And most probably, he's talking in a new reality. Rav Kook was talking when you had farming and you had people who were shepherding using the ancient method of shepherding, grazing all over. Whereas the 1950s and 60s, it's a different story. Right now, those people who want to raise sheep do them in closed areas, like Mary Beth said earlier. And says Rav Frank that there's no reason to reinstitute the gzeirah once it has been uninstituted by the Shulchan Aruch. Last source I want to see on the subject is Rav Shul Yisraeli. Rav Shul Yisraeli.
Rabbi, just going back, sorry.
Yeah.
It doesn't sound like he's saying anything about it being a new way of doing things.
He's right. You're right. I said that.
So that's reading.
That's reading into it. You're right. Then.
By the way, I worked with sheep in a kibbutz at one point, and they were still sending them to graze, but the fields that they were grazing were fields of the kibbutz.
Yeah. So Rav Shul Yisraeli was a very, very well-known Israeli rabbi in the religious Zionist sector. He's now deceased. And he wrote a book of Shelot and Tshuvot, right? Questions and answers, response, called Amud Yemini. And he writes the following. Uvizman hazeh shayishuv bichalo mefik toelet Megidul Beimot Dakot, translation, and in our time, that the general yeshuv, the general population of the land of Israel, Mefik Toelet, gets a benefit from Gidul Beimot Dakot, from raising sheep and goats. In other words, it's good for the economy of Eretz Israel that there is such a thing. It's no longer an impediment to the economy. Today, it's a benefit to the economy. Bifrat Akshav, Shavulot Misaviv Skurim, especially now that the boundaries around are closed. So today when people raise sheep, they have sheep pens. So
I thought it was the other way, that you can't go to Syria, that the borders are closed.
No. No. That's not what he means. Vatam Shamru Shambigmara Shafshal Haviyami no Kayam. Here's referring to something we didn't learn yet. So the time was going quickly, so I didn't learn this source with you together. What the Gemara had said is, I guess I'll have to tell you this now, and it comes back to something Ilana asked many times. What's the difference between Beima Daka and Beima Gasa? Between animals that are thin, like sheep and goats, and animals that are heavy, like cattle, what's the difference? What the Gemara had said is, the difference is the following. That as far as sheep and goats, we can import them from outside the land of Israel for special celebrations. If you're having a festive meal for your son's bar mitzvah or for a holiday, you can import the meat from outside the land of Israel. And when I say import the meat, in those days they didn't import meat, they imported sheep and goats, and they kept them tied to their bed for a few days until they slaughtered it. You can do that with sheep and goats. You can't do it with cattle. You can't tie it to your bed for a few days until you slaughter it. Mm-hmm. Not only can't you do that, but importing cattle is very expensive because they're big and heavy. Importing sheep is not so hard. You can put them on a camel. You can put sheep and goats on camels. You can't put them on. You can't put cattle on camels. So the Gemara says.
Besides, if you tie the cow to your bed will move.
So the Gemara says simply that it's true that cattle also do damage to the land.
Thank you.
But there's no way to prevent people from raising them, because otherwise there'd be no meat. Whereas sheep and goats, we can prevent people. We can tell them, import it from Syria.
Actually, cattle damage the land much more. I mean cows, because they use a lot of earth resources. It's one of the things that they talk about vegetarianism.
Yeah, I've read
that. It's very destructive.
Back when I was a teenager, I read that. It's a book called Diet for a Small Planet.
Small Planet, yeah.
So anyway, he says the following. Vatam shamru sham bigmara shavshah lahaviyam ino kayam. And the reasoning they gave in the Gemara that it's possible to import them doesn't exist today. Today you can't, he says, you can't import to Eretz Yisrael. You can't depend on the importation of sheep and goat if you want to maintain a strong economy. It'll be too expensive. You have to raise them if you want their meat. Kilavi mi merhak, because to import them from a distance, hareze karuch b'chutzot merubot, is involved with this great expense. V'nosaf al zeh, in addition to this, hareze mefrayes halakim chashuvim shel yishuv. In addition to this, behold, this supports important parts of the yishuv, of the Jewish settlement. Today, again, it's not a impediment to the economy of the land. It is a benefit to the economy because many people make their living from sheep and goats. On the one hand, it's good for some people. It helps them. On the other hand, it doesn't cause any damage because they do it in closed pens, so there's no problem. After the comma, in the middle of the third line, Shemishum kach, Yesh ladun shvadai kayemet haskama kvalit v'nechonut shelo lakpid mitzad ha'isur shelo ligrom nezek. And because of this, the things he just said, that the farmers, it doesn't bother them because it's done in closed pens and many people it benefits, because of this, there is to say that certainly exists a haskama, kvalit, a general agreement, v'nechonut, and a readiness not to be strict with this prohibition about not causing damage. Because, again, it doesn't cause damage. Umimele ein kan shemisur klal. And therefore, there's no prohibition here at all. I guess I don't have to read any more. Yeah, that's enough to reading
what
now.
What is hanan? Shei nun lamed ayni. Nun dal.
Hanira la aniyut da'ati.
Hanira
la'aniyut da'ati.
Ah! How do you know all that?
So anyway, the halacha today seems to be that if you want to raise sheep and goats in Eretz Israel, you can do so.
The truth would be told, there was a huge conflict with the Bedouins grazing, and they love to graze in the nature reservations. And for some reason, the nature reservation supervisors didn't like them to destroy their nature reservations. I was very involved with that at one point.
Yeah, so that certainly
so
causes conflict.
So are there rules that you can't...
There are rules.
Can you let them wander freely around? I mean, if you're out...
No. The assumption, again, is that it's in closed circumstances.
In an enclosed area.
And of course, like we said, if they do cause damage, you have to pay.
They're not in a pen.
You mean among the Bedouin, they're not in the pen?
No, also in the kibbutzim, they graze, but they graze in land that is owned by them.
But but they do have something to close them a little bit, or they can just graze out?
I guess ask Ilana.
No, they graze that's the job of the shepherd, to keep them in the confined area. But they're not in a pen. A sheep would just die being in a pen.
No, well, I didn't think they're going.
They're not like cows that you can leave in a shed.
Okay, so this, to whatever extent it ever applied, only applied in certain areas, how can they use Etzel and then What are these other regions? Like, there were regions that you could do it. There was never this blanket prohibition of raising
right
sheep and goats in desert. All of the, however you'd characterize it, the political boundaries.
Right.
It sounds like so.
Really, we should have talked about that earlier, and I neglected it. So really, let's go back and think, what are we talking about here? There's two things. One is the geographical, the other is the political. So geographically speaking, areas that are not conducive to farming, that's where the rabbis allowed sheep grazing. So we're talking about Midbar Yehuda, the Judean desert. It includes Tekoa, right, where the prophet Amos was, all the way to the Dead Sea from Jerusalem in the direction of Male Adumim. There's no farming there. There's no rain, except for a few weeks during the winter, and there's no springs there. There is a lot that the sheep can eat during certain weeks of the year, and they can graze there then, but they're not doing any damage to farming because there is no farming there. So that's the Midbarot, and in Syria, I think the matter is it's not part of Eretz Yisrael. So there's no mitzvah yishuv there.
It's
not part of Eretz Canaan.
Uh-huh.
Right.
Again, we're talking about like the area that... like the half of Manasseh and the other, that region?
Torah says was great for sheep grazing.
Uh-huh.
Right, so they were on the other side of the Jordan,
mm-hmm.
both in today what is Transjordan and today what is the Golan Heights.
Mm-hmm.
But Syria here is only the Golan Heights and even further north than that.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So... that's geographically. Now, politically, what are we talking about? We're talking about the aftermath of the destruction of the Second Temple.
Right.
When at least 1 million Jews were killed and exiled, there were still Jews, many Jews in Eretz Yisrael in the year 80, the year 90, the year 100 of the Common Era, but it's getting economically and politically more and more difficult. Many Jews are leaving. You then move to the Hadrianic persecution, the Bar Kokhba revolt in the year 120, 130, 140 of the Common Era. The persecution is more difficult economically, the situation is dire, and the rabbis are trying to prevent Jews from leaving Eretz Yisrael. This Isur we're talking about was one of the efforts of the rabbis to maintain a Jewish hold on the land. By the way, the effort failed. Right, the fact that by the time you get to the year 600 of the Common Era, there are Jews in Eretz Yisrael, but not that many,
mm-hmm.
was not because of any type of explicit expulsion. It was rather the continued Roman economic hard hand, and the Jews just couldn't keep land. By the way, I have to add to it: a farmer has to pay taxes because he owns mm-hmm. the land. The shepherd doesn't have to pay taxes.
Mm-hmm.
There was a great temptation on the part of many, many Jews in difficult economic times to sell the land, get out of the tax, and then buy some sheep and goats and raise them on the land. But you don't own the land, you don't have to pay taxes to the Romans. The rabbis are trying to fight against that phenomena. And again, the rabbis didn't succeed. Otherwise, Jewish history would have looked differently. But the Romans never expelled, after the year 130, the Romans didn't expel Jews. They just made it very, very difficult for Jews to live there. Okay, so there's a lot more we can learn. I guess, just again, tell me again what time it is.
Who did they expel until the year 130?
So then, in the aftermath of the destruction of the Second Temple, there were hundreds of thousands of Jews who were taken slave and sold around the Roman Empire.
Oh.
And the same thing happened in the aftermath of the Bar Kokhba Rebellion. But once the rebellion was finished and whoever died and was sent into exile, the rest of the Jews left there were left. They were never exiled again by the Romans in any type of political, specific political move. But economically, the Romans made it very, very difficult to live there. So the time is 3:30.
There is a theory that some of the Arabs that live in Israel were descendants.
Yeah, I read that. Yeah, I read that.
Something occurred to me. We're talking about that no Dakot because no Behemoth Dakot because of yeshiva haaretz, right? Mm-hmm. But obviously, but then the Mishnah says you can do it in the midbar. Are we suggesting then in the midbar that there's no yeshiva, no mitzvah yeshiva haaretz there?
Mm-hmm. Let there's no mitzvah, but there's no possibility of farming. Uh-huh. So you're not disturbing anyone.
Right. Okay, I see. You're not reversing the yeshiva haaretz.
So there could be communities, but not farming communities.
Well, separate communities.
I guess so. Uh-huh. There could be shepherding communities.
Right.
To this very day, you see a lot of Bedouin.
Oh yeah.
Right in Midbar Yehuda, following the grasses.
With their
flocks.
Are there settlements in those areas?
Jewish settlements, yeah. Malei Adumim.
Mm-hmm. So where nowadays you don't have to, are not dependent on farming, it's more a matter of cheap housing.
Water being piped in mm-hmm. from desalination plants.
So there's a yeshuv, but not an agricultural.
Yeah. And the only problem is the goats eat your grass. Mm. So we can go on a few more minutes if you want. Chris, of course we can. Is that okay?
Answer all the kushiyot.
Well, I want to talk about pigs a little bit.
Yeah.
You want to eat first?
No, let's talk a little about if they go.
Yeah.
Okay, so again, next month from 2 to 4.
2 to 4,
okay, thank you.
So I'll just say a little bit about pigs.
I will not be here. I'm going out of town. Isn't that terrible?
You have to send a replacement. You have to send a replacement.
Next month.
I just need to get what you're talking about. I have to do, from Mary Beth or someone, what you talked about.
I understand.
That'll be the last time that I'm here, and then next time you'll just have to catch me up when you come back to Israel, then, because I'll be moving after that.
Are you moving?
I'm moving after. Yeah, December is going to be. No, next time. December is going to be my last time that I'll be meeting with the Rav Schlesinger here in Dallas, and then at the end of December, we're going to Virginia briefly for maybe 3 weeks or a month to visit with Vicky's family, and then off to Israel from there. So
you got a job? You got anything?
Well, they won't. I mean, the general idea that I'm getting is that you can't get a job until you actually live there and you can show your tudat zehut there. But and then you might get hired, but they won't hire you anywhere until you actually move. Right, so that's a way of saying no, I don't have anything lined up. But they just renewed a. First of all, Vicky's got a few ways that she might be able to start something pretty quickly. Anyway, the woman that we spoke with with the Jewish Agency, because we're thinking of moving up north, said that Carmel will be a nice place if Vicky wants to do like a gun out of her house or something. So she can watch the baby be with the baby and also watch some other babies that in Carmel they really like English speaking guns. So Vicky might be able to do that.
And you could be a sheep herder.
Yeah, well, I'll see. But I have a lot of customer service experience, but also what I'm thinking to do is they just renewed the voucher program in Israel, which is a program by which new Olim can get vouchers for up to, I think, 80% of the cost of classes to retrain in different things. And I'm looking more at like retraining in tech, because up north I'm told that high-tech jobs are in demand up north a lot.
You're bringing to Newcastle.
I may retrain in something like that, or technical writing maybe would be something that I feel like I could do, A, because I could freelance, so even if I don't have a set job doing that, I could find jobs to do like that with technical writing. And so that's kind of a direction that I'm going in, besides just looking to see if I can get accepted to a master's program, because the State of Israel will pay, if I start within 2 years of my Aliyah and before I'm 30, the State of Israel will pay for my master's degree. So I just have to figure if I can get accepted to a master's program, which is a big gift because I was a horrible student.
Ilana, I want to talk a few minutes about the Chazirim.
Okay.
Is that okay?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, and send you out. See you.
Bye.
Bye.
So we have like, let's take 10 or 15 minutes to talk about the matter of pigs.
Where?
So I am on the piece of paper that is the second to the last piece of paper. And at the top, it says Tosefta, and then there's a dotted line, about 10 dots. And then it says Rambam.
Yeah.
So we won't look at all the sources. Mm-hmm. There's a machloket here. I'll tell you the basic machloket. The Rambam holds that this prohibition against raising pigs in any place in the world is really just part of a general prohibition of raising any type of beimat tmeah, any type of unkosher animal.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas the Tosfot holds differently. Tosfot says it's specifically pigs. He doesn't explain why specifically pigs. The Gemara might give us a hint to that, as we'll see. He says that the truth is that other animals, you're allowed to raise them, unkosher animals, and although you're not allowed to eat them, you're allowed indeed to get benefit from them. You're allowed to get benefit from them.
Wow.
There's a basic machloket here. And again, we won't go into the sources, we don't have time. What I want to do is talk about the reason the Gemara gives for this specific mention of pigs. Again, the commentators have a debate whether it specifically mentions pigs, but it means all the animals, or it just means pigs. That's a question that I said is a disagreement. But what the Gemara points out is a historical reason why the Mishnah specifically mentions pigs. And this is fascinating, because the Gemara gives us a version of the story, and then there's another version of it in Josephus. Very, very similar. You forgot something.
Yeah. I didn't even see that.
I would have kept it for you.
Oh, definitely your beans are school also.
So let's look at what the Gemara says, and this is the second to last Hebrew source on the page. The second to last Hebrew source on the page. Mm-hmm. It says Talmud Bavli Masechet Bava Kama Daf Pei Bet Amud Bet. Ein Megadlim Hazirim Bechol Makom. We do not raise pigs in any place. Tanu Rabbanan, our rabbis taught in a Braita. Shitzaru Beit Hashmonai Ze Al Ze. When the Hasmonean dynasty besieged each other. What are we talking about? Talk about the following. We know that in the year 163 approximately, before the Common Era, was the Hasmonean, the Maccabean revolt against the Greek Syrians. The battles took about 2 years, 3 years, and eventually control of the land was wrested from the Greek Syrians, and the Hasmoneans became the rulers. Within two generations, their rule degenerated into something very, very unfortunate. Fratricide and civil war and different clans and different families fighting with each other. It wasn't a happy time. We have over 100 years there of inter-Jewish fighting among the aristocracy. And at one point we're told that two clans were fighting over the right to rule. And that's what we're talking about here in this ancient Braita. So again, it says, "Shetzaru beit Hashmonai ze al ze," when the Hasmoneans were fighting with each other. Haya Horkunus mi bifnim v'Aristobulus mi bechutz. So Horkunus, one of the ruling class, was inside, means he controlled the Temple Mount. And Aristobulus mi bechutz, where Aristobulus, which who, I don't know if his brother or his cousin, had troops outside the Temple Mount besieging Horkunus, who was inside.
Lovely.
Yeah, a lot of fun. Jews killing each other. Well, the chol yom hayu meshalshalim lehem bekupa dinarim, vayu ma'alim lehem timidim. Translation: and every day, the ones inside in Temple Mount would lower down by a rope a bucket of gold coins, and the troops on the outside would take the money and lower up on the rope two animals for the daily sacrifices, the timidim.
Okay, so meaning they're at war with each other, but they're working with each other to have
to make sure the korbanot is right. You have to serve God. You might kill your brother, but as long as you can do serving God, it's Beit HaMikdash.
That's just
right?
Absurd.
Hayah sham zaken echad shayah makir b'chokhmat yevanit. There was an old man there that knew Chochma Yevanit. He knew Greek wisdom. It's another way of saying that he was a Hellenized Jew. And the Talmud apparently has suspicions of Hellenized Jews.
Uh-huh.
Amar lehem, he said to them, he said to the men outside, to Aristobulus' troops, he said, Kozman shoskin bavuda ein nimserim biyadchem. All the while that they're involved in the avodah, all the while that the troops of Hyrcanus on the Temple Mount are involved in serving God, the avodat Beit HaMikdash, the worship of the temple, ein nimserim biyadchem. God won't allow them to be delivered into your hands because they're doing the sacrifices. So he was saying, again, this is on the outside, he's saying to the troops on the outside, why are you giving them sacrifices? Because you're actually delaying the your conquering of the Temple Mount. As long as they bring sacrifices, you can't conquer them, because God is pleased with it. Lemachar, I'm in the last two words of the third line, Lemachar shil shalu dinarim bekupa ve'elu lehem chazir. The next day, when they let down the gold coins, the troops on the inside, the troops on the outside sent up a pig. Instead of sending up the proper sacrifice, they sent up a pig. Because they understood that if we don't give them sacrifices, perhaps we'll be able to win the battle. God will no longer be with them. Kevan shegia lechatzi achoma, na'at siporna bechoma v'nizda'aza Eretz Yisrael arbamot parsa al arbamot parsa. When the pig got to Chatzia Choma, in other words, the men on the Temple Mount were bringing up the pig, which they thought was a proper sacrifice. When the pig got, being pulled up by the string, to the middle point of the wall, it stuck its claws into the wall and refused to be pulled up higher. And it started screaming, and all of the land of Israel was in tremors for 400 parsot to 400 parsot. In other words, a great calamity happened in the land of Israel because of this pig that was about to be brought up to the Temple Mount. Bota sha'a amru arur ha'ish shigadel chazirim. Varur hadam shilamedet beno chokhma yevanit. So at that very time, they said, cursed is the man that will raise pigs, and cursed is the man that will teach his children Greek wisdom. Because again, it was a Hellenized Jew that had this idea of sending up a pig. So the idea is that's the source. That's why pigs are so despicable in Jewish eyes, because of this very incident. And that's why the Mishnah says...
Tell me, so they already didn't like pigs.
Pigs are not kosher, but also camels aren't kosher, and horses aren't kosher, but Jews don't have a reticence concerning camels, but we have a reticence concerning pigs. So this particular bright to claim the reason is because of this event.
Who would have wanted the pig to go on up?
Right.
No, they sent the pig up.
Yes.
To...
And the pig was like saying, no, I...
The troops on the outside sent the pig up because they wanted to send a message to the troops inside that we're not giving you any more sacrifices to sacrifice.
Uh-huh.
But the pig was holding back.
The pig, in a sense, was holding back. So anyway, the claim of the Gemara is that's the source of the special prohibition against raising pigs any place in the world, because this terrible, terrible event that once happened. And we'll close by just pointing out that Josephus Flavius, in his History of the Jews, has a record of the same event. It's not exactly the same, but it's pretty similar. So let's just read it, and then we will come to a conclusion.
Rabbi, what is that... what is that? Omer miganot hatzrifim.
Yeah, so Ilana is asking, what about the last line I didn't translate? What that is the following. It's saying that at that time, the land was so traumatized by this event that the Omer had it be brought from ginot hatzrifim. The Omer, of course, we're talking about the holiday of Pesach, the bringing of a certain measure of barley to the Beit HaMikdash, and the land was so traumatized by the wars between the Jews that there was no barley to be found in the area of Jerusalem. They had to go so far away to bring the Omer of barley.
Where is Tzrifim?
I assume it's someplace near the present-day Tzrifim, which is about a half hour, south of the airport? 15 minutes south of the airport?
Between Ramat Gan and Tel Aviv.
Right, something like that. But it's nowhere near Jerusalem.
And where is Bikat Ein Sukkah?
I didn't look it up. I'm not sure we know, but the idea is it's far away from Jerusalem. So anyway, Josephus writes the following. Let's just read Josephus. After these promises had been given to Aretas, don't ask me who Aretas is, I'm not familiar with Second Temple history, he made an expedition against Aristobulus, who we saw mentioned in the bright in the Gemara, right? He made an expedition against Aristobulus with an army of 50,000 horse and foot and beat him in the battle. When after that victory, many went over to Hyrcanus as deserters. Hyrcanus we saw mentioned, right? Aristobulus and Hyrcanus are, they're members of the Hasmonean dynasty, and they're fighting each other. Aristobulus was left desolate and fled to Jerusalem, upon which the king of Arabia took all his army and made an assault upon the temple and besieged Aristobulus therein, the people still supporting Hyrcanus and assisting him in the siege, while none but the priests continue with Aristobulus. So it sounds like the Jewish people are divided between two different camps, and then you have the king of Arabia is also involved in the fray. Mm-hmm. So Aretas united the forces of the Arabians and of the Jews together, of one camp of the Jews, and pressed on the siege vigorously against the other camp of the Jews who were in the Temple Mount. As this happened at the time when the Feast of Unleavened Bread was celebrated, Pesach, which we call Passover, the principal men among the Jews had left the country and fled into Egypt. Now there was one whose name was Onias. A righteous man he was and beloved of God, when a certain drought had prayed to God to put an end to the intense heat, and whose prayers God had heard and had sent them rain. This man had hid himself because he saw that this sedition would last a great while.
Maybe that's Choni.
Yeah, Choni. Is that Choni? Yeah.
Could be. The H becomes A.
Yeah.
I don't know. Yeah. However, they brought him to the Jewish camp and desired that as by his prayers he had once put an end to the drought, so he would in like manner make imprecations, those curses, on Aristobulus and those of his faction. So the men of Hyrcanus wanted to use this righteous man to curse Aristobulus. Reminds me of Bilam. Mm-hmm. And when upon his refusal, he didn't want to curse other Jews, and the excuses that he made, he was still by the multitude compelled to speak. He stood up in the midst of them and said, O God, the King of the whole world, Eloheinu Melech Olam, since those that stand now with me are thy people, and those that are besieged are also thy priests, right, the men inside the Temple Mount, I beseech thee that thou will neither hearken to the prayers of those against these, nor bring to effect what these pray against those. Don't listen to anyone's prayer, he said, because they're Jews trying to kill each other.
Lovely.
Whereupon such wicked Jews as stood about him, as soon as he had made the prayer, stoned him to death. That's the Jews for you. But God punished them immediately for this their barbarity, and took vengeance of them for the murder of Onias in the manner following. While the priests and Aristobulus were besieged in the Temple Mount, it happened that the feast called the Passover was come, at which it is our custom to offer a great number of sacrifices to God. But those that were with Aristobulus wanted sacrifice. In other words, they didn't have animals up in the Temple Mount, and desired that their countrymen without, and outside of the Temple Mount, who were besieging them, would furnish them with such sacrifices, and assured them they should have as much money for them as they should desire. We'll pay you if you send us sacrifices. And when they required them to pay 1,000 drachma of each head of cattle, Aristobulus and the priests willingly undertook to pay for them accordingly. And those within let down the money over the walls and gave it to them. But when the others had received it, they did not deliver the sacrifices, but arrived at the height of wickedness as to break the assurances they had given and to be guilty of impiety towards God by not furnishing those that wanted them with sacrifices. So it doesn't mention any pig here. And when the priests found they had been cheated and that the agreements they had made were violated, they prayed to God that he would avenge them on their countrymen. Nor did he delay that their punishment, but sent a strong and vehement storm of wind that destroyed the fruits of the whole country, till a modius of wheat was then bought for 11 drachma, which reminds us of the sentence at the end that says the country was so decimated that you couldn't bring an omer from any place except from far, far away.
It's amazing. Wow. Multiple attestation of the same story. It's amazing.
Yeah.
Wow.
Okay.
Now we need to feed you. This is... Unacceptable.
A Jewish mother.
God. I'm happy to eat.
Good.
A lava.
Thank you guys for joining us.
Rabbi.